Thank you, Alvin. Good morning. I'd like to start this morning by thanking you all for your prayers. Had a little problem on my last trip. Actually, if I had to have that problem, I was in the best place. I have it away from home. The people up there were wonderful. They were just like family to us. But I also know that the prayers of you all made a big difference in what they did to me and my recovery and everything, and there is nothing wrong with my heart. I have one, and there's nothing wrong with it, and that's a medical fact now. So we'll just go from there. But thank you again for all your concern. I'd like to begin this morning with a reading out of the third book of Nephi. Very familiar verse to us, very familiar passage to us, I guess is the way of saying it. Now I'm going to start in the 12th chapter, and I'm going to start with the 16th verse. This is Jesus talking. He says, "And they saith unto him, Lord, we will that thou wouldst tell us a name whereby we shall call this church. For there are disputations among the people concerning this matter. And the Lord said unto them, Verily, verily, I say unto you, why is it that the people should murmur and dispute because of this thing? Have they not read the scriptures? Which saith, ye must take upon you the name of Christ, which is my name. For by this name ye shall be called at the last day. And whoso taketh upon him my name and endureth to the end, the same shall be saved at the last day. Therefore, whatsoever ye shall do, ye shall do it in my name. Therefore, ye shall call a church in my name. And ye shall call upon the Father in my name, that he will bless the church for my sake. And howbeit my church, save it, be called in my name. For if a church be called in Moses' name, then it be Moses' church. Or if it be called in the name of a man, then it be the church of a man. But if it be called in my name, then it is my church. If it so be that they are built upon my gospel." There's that last phrase now. That last phrase is what got me to thinking here a while back. This is the Church of Christ. This is what we call our church. And when someone asks us, why do we call our church what we call it? 99 times out of 100, this is what I hear for a reference. And I believe it. But there's other churches in this world that call themselves the Church of Christ, or the disciples of Christ, or the church of God. So it can't just be in the name. There's got to be something more to it. People have done this for millennia, have called their churches the Church of the Lord, or the Church of Christ, or the Church of God, or God's church. And it wasn't. So why isn't it? What's going on? What has been going on? Do we really understand what the term Church of Christ means? I just read it to you. It's that last little phrase. It's an organization that says it's the Church of Christ and is based upon the gospel of Christ. Okay. That's a good rhetorical argument that everybody can give, and they all say the same thing. Well, it is. Our church is based on the gospel. So that's not a good argument, and that's not a good answer. I think what you got to do to really understand what it means of basing a church upon the gospel of Christ is get into the information that we have and see what's gone on before, what's gone wrong, what's gone right, and what Jesus Christ says about it. Not what Roger Bruner says about it, not my opinion, not my ideas. One of the things that you find in history is mentioned in Romans. And I'm going to start with this concept here in Romans. It's in the first chapter of Romans. First chapter of Romans, and I'm going to start with... Well, just for a place to start, I'm going to start with verse 18. Now, this ends up talking about something else here, but there's a comment that Paul makes here that I think is pretty germane to what's on my mind this morning. It says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who hold the truth in unrighteousness." Unrighteousness only means you're not obeying. If you're righteous in something, you're just plain obeying. That's all it means. You're not sanctified. You're not blessed. It's not some big, high, lofty, eloquent concept. If you're righteous in something, you're obeying that law. That's it. Okay. "Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it unto them. For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made." We do that all the time. We say that all the time. We just say it in a different way. We know God created the heavens and the earth and everything that in them is. And you can't see everything that's there, but you see the results of it. You can't see your faith, but you can see the results of it. You can't see humility, but you can see the results of it. You can't see pride, but you can see the results of it. "For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the earth are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because that, when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, into birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their own hearts to dishonor their own bodies between themselves." Faith is something that you can stand and talk about. And for whatever the reason the mankind does it, you can sit there and you can get somebody all enthused about faith and hope and charity and all of these things they're not something that I can set one up here and show you. It's abstract. It's a concept. But it's a powerful concept. So what men end up doing when they fail to go back and continue to read what Jesus Christ did or what Jesus Christ says, they may even start off at times to make something that's material that you can sit there to look at to remind you of what it is. I just read it. They're idols. Too many people all through history have taken the Word of God and then have made idols out of it that take them away from God. Sometime back here, I was in 2 Kings several months ago here, 22nd chapter, where for 55 years, they'd forgot their Bible or their book of the law. I'm going to call it a Bible just because that's what we translate that concept over to today. So in the 22nd chapter of 2 Kings, and it's Josiah that was a righteous king. They were doing their day-to-day things, and the house of the Lord They were calling it the house of the Lord, and they didn't know about their book of the law. They didn't even know it existed. They weren't disobeying it. They were ignorant of it. In their house of the Lord. They had a complete organization set up. They had a complete religion set up that had nothing in it that the Bible or the Book of Mormon contained. And they called it the house of the Lord. So because they had no knowledge of this, or they had forgotten it, or whatever they had done to get rid of this, to where the book was accidentally found, that talks about it in verse 8 there in the 22nd chapter. Then Josiah has the book read to him. He repents. He goes through a process here to verify that the book is true. And then it starts on chapter 23 and all the things that they had to dismantle out of their church, out of their house of the Lord, to make it line up with the book of the law. I'm not going to read it because it goes for a chapter and a half. But it was idols. It was practices. It was procedures. It was rituals. It was all the things that they were calling a religion in their house of the Lord. And none of it was in the Bible. So what is idolatry? That's what I'm talking about. How do you know when you are on the threshold of practicing idolatry? Smith's Bible Dictionary has got a pretty good definition. I'm going to read it to you. So strictly speaking, idolatry denotes the worship of deity in a visible form, whether the images to which homage is paid are symbolical representations of the true God or are the false divinities which have been made objects of worship in his stead. So you can worship an idol in place of God and say it's of God. Now, I had to think about that. I really had to think about that concept. But it's true. Once you really get to looking at it, and I'm going to read a little bit further in the scriptures, and I'm going to show you where it's very true that we can be susceptible, if we don't watch it, to worshiping things that are not scriptural. To worshiping things, placing a higher value on things outside the scriptures as opposed to what's in the scriptures. Jesus Christ himself, well, no, I'm getting ahead of myself here. I'm going to go to Numbers to give you an idea. One of the things that we tend to do, and people have done it all the way down through the ages, is that when something extraordinary happens in a spiritual sense, something very religious or we perceive to be very religious occurs, and it's mouthed about and it's spread about and it becomes well known and it's a big deal and everybody's impressed by it, within two or three generations, whatever that is, becomes an entity to itself. It becomes its own thing out here that's special. And if it's fed, it becomes an idol. If I'm standing here reading this Bible, there's all of you out there watching. Now, this is a poor example, but this is the only one I can think of right off the top of my head. And all of a sudden, this Bible starts to glow golden. You're going to see it. I have no idea why it would have turned golden to where not one of you saw it, but let's say all of you saw it. And it's mouthed about that this minister was standing up here and he was reading his Bible and it just had a golden glow about it. And it was really something special and it excited everybody and it really impressed them. If you don't watch it, then this will end up being its idol, this book. And you will completely, it will, the original intent of this book will be completely taken away. You will no longer be concentrating on what's in the book, but on the book itself. Go to Numbers, 21st chapter, and I'll show you how it happened. And I'm going to start with the fifth verse in the 21st chapter of Numbers. And the people spake against God and against Moses. This is the children are wandering in the wilderness. They have all of these things that are going on. Wherefore have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no bread, neither there is any water, and our soul loatheth this light bread, which was the manna. And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people. And much people of Israel died. Therefore the people came to Moses and said, We have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against thee. Pray unto the Lord that he take away the serpents from us. And Moses prayed for the people. And the Lord said unto Moses, Make thee a fiery serpent, set it upon a pole, and it shall come to pass that everyone that is bitten, when he looketh upon it, he shall live. He didn't take away the serpents, did he? He didn't answer their prayers. He did something else. And Moses made a serpent of brass and put it upon a pole. And it came to pass that if a serpent had bitten any man, when he beheld the serpent of brass, he lived. An extraordinary event. Something that God created to again try to get people to understand who he was and what he was about and where they are in relation to him. Now go to 2 Kings, 18th chapter. I don't know whether this is a decade later, whether this is a century later. I don't know. That's not important, but there was a period of time here. 2 Kings, 18th chapter. And I guess, to really get it started right, I'm going to start with the first verse. Now it came to pass in the third year of Hoshea, the son of Elah, king of Israel, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. 25 years old was he when he began to reign, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name also was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah. And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that David his father did. He removed the high places and brake the images and cut down the groves and brake in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made. For unto those days the children of Israel did burn incense to it, and he called it Nehushtan. They had taken this object that Moses made at the direction of God that saved the lives of those who looked upon it, and they made it an idol. That's why I said what I said about this book a while ago. We are prone to do that. We are still prone to do that. I'm not saying you're doing it. I'm saying we are prone to do that. Only nowadays, too many times, and it started in the time of Christ, we no longer even have to have an object. All we need is a concept. And it will change our idea of who God is and what he's about and what we should be concentrating on that has to do with the welfare of our souls. Jesus talked about it in Matthew. Not Matthew, that's Luke. 23rd chapter of Matthew. This religion had been going on for 300 years before Christ started talking about it like this. In fact, it had been going on longer than that, but it had really ripened into this type of religion within the 300 years previous to this occurring here. That's longer than this country, or almost as long as this country has been in existence. To give you an idea of history and the span of history, it didn't take that long, looking at all of history, for this to occur. And he's talking about the Pharisees. And he's not talking about them as men. He's been talking about them about what they did with the church of God. And I'm going to say it that way. They dwelt so much on their rituals, and they dwelt so much on their ceremonies, and they picked everything apart and had to make a little bigger rule for everything, instead of obeying the principles that guides their lives, that they ended up being religious if they just did it all right. And this is what he had to say about that idol. Chapter 23 of Matthew, I'm going to start with the first verse. Then spake Jesus to the multitude and to his disciples, saying, The scribes and Pharisees sat in Moses' seat. All therefore whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do. But do not ye after their works, for they say, and do not. Now you see, he's telling them to do that at that point because he hasn't been resurrected. The Mosaic law did not have an end at this point. They were still under the Mosaic law. So that's why he's saying that at this point. When he was resurrected, the Mosaic law had an end. It says so in the Book of Mormon, two or three places. It doesn't say it's fulfilled only. It says there's an end to it. For they bind heavy burdens and grievous to be borne and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. But all their works they do for to be seen of men. They make broad their phylacteries and make and enlarge the borders of their garments and love the uppermost rooms at feasts and the chief seats in the synagogues, greetings in the marketplace and to be called of men, Rabbi, Rabbi. I can go on and on and on for a couple of pages here. They took a whole set of ceremonies, and they took a whole set of things that they got out of the Bible, out of the Torah, out of the first five books of the Old Testament that we still have, and they made a religion that had nothing to do with God. And they did it with enthusiasm, they did it with fervor, they did it with a firm conviction, and you couldn't blow them out of that idea with a stick of dynamite. And they killed Jesus Christ because of it. And none of it was what they were supposed to be doing. That's how pervasive this idea is. That's how long it's been around, and it hasn't gone away. This church, as an entity, cannot say we believe in this and we don't believe in that. That's your job. That's my job. And my job is not to stand here and berate and belittle you because of what you believe. I've said it many times from here, and I'll say it and say it and say it. It's my job to get you to think. Yeah, honestly, to get you to think. And to get in here and look at these wonderful stories and all of this information and all of these things that have been here for centuries, and to get you to read them and then think. You have idols. I have idols that we should get rid of. What are your idols? I don't know, but I know what mine are. But they're the things that take away from the gospel of Jesus Christ in our lives that pertains to the church. It's the things that are traditions that become more important than the gospel. It's history that becomes more important than the gospel. It's events that have become more important than the gospel. It's things that have happened that have been built out of proportion that have become more important than the gospel. You know what, you will find what those things are in your heart if you get in here and look. And our forefathers certainly did that in this church. There were things in the early church, in the early church of Christ, that were not scriptural. Tells you so in the outline history. There's a lot of them. And when they searched the scriptures and found out that they didn't exist, they removed them from the church. And the church grew. This will be a never-ending process with us because we're human beings. You always have to be vigilant. You always have to be alert to the fact, whoops, I'm getting off base here. Because it's easier to get back on base where you're an inch off than 10 years later when you're a mile off and it's all set in concrete. So I've talked about idols and I've talked about idolatry and the dangers of that. So what do you replace it with if you find things that are in your religious life that you need to remove? Because there's going to be a vacuum there, and you got to know what you want in there in that vacuum. And it's all over the scriptures what should be there. And it's all of those things that you can't see. You can only see the results of. I can start with two. I don't even have to go to it. Thou shalt love thy Lord thy God with all thy might, mind, and strength, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. That's the two scriptures that Jesus Christ picked when he was asked that question. Out of everything that's back here and all of the things that they had been going on for centuries, one of them is in Deuteronomy 6 and the other one's in Leviticus 19. He didn't invent them. All he did was quote the Old Testament. He didn't invent anything. He never made it up. He just reiterated. It had been there all along, and they ignored it. So how do you do that? Well, see, that's two verses. Pretty much rhetorical, pretty general. So what else is in here? Well, you remember how in the mouths of two or three all things are established? All that is a verification. And in my work when I was a police officer, that was it. If you couldn't verify things, it was of no value to you in court or anywhere else. You had to have it verified. And it's the same thing. In the mouths of two or three witnesses, all things are established. Same concept. So I'm going to read a couple of places here where you shall love the Lord with all your heart, might, mind, and strength, and you'll love your neighbor as yourself, and you break it down to a few elements here. And see how these match up against your idea of religion. First one I'm going to read is in 2 Peter. Most of your books in the New Testament were written two people who had no idea of what the gospel of Jesus Christ was. So they had all of these things in the front. They had all of these things that were introductories, orientation, whatever you want to call it, all this information that's in the front. There were other places where they had to address problems where people got astray also. But there's a common thread that runs through all of these. And I picked three places where it says the same thing. So it's verified. I'm going to start with verse 4, chapter 1, 2 Peter. Whereby are given unto us exceeding great and precious promises, that by these ye might be partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that is in the world through lust. That's why we do it. That's information for me. And beside this, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, and to knowledge temperance, and to temperance patience, and to patience godliness, and to godliness brotherly love, brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness charity. There's nine. And if you notice, you've got to have the first one before you can get the second one right. And you've got to get the first one and second one right to get the third one right. It's a progressive thing. It's like a 10-step math problem. You get the first step wrong, Everything else was wrong. So let's go to Galatians. Fifth chapter of Galatians, we probably know it by heart. 22nd verse. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. It's the same thing, just different words. It's the same concepts. It gets you to the same place. You arrive at the same conclusions. Those are markers as you're walking down your road of life. Those are markers you can see. They're things that you can look in the mirror of the morning or and see in yourself. There's indicators there that tell you whether someone else is doing what they're supposed to be doing or not, and how you're supposed to help them get back on that road or on that narrow path. It's information. Go to Matthew. Fifth chapter of Matthew. I'll probably read this enough to drive a lot of you crazy. Nine things. Don't get hung up on the number nine. It's just that it happens that these three are the most definitive. These are the places where it's the most definitive. These things are in groups of six, and they're in groups of twos, and they're in groups of fours. It all means the same thing. It's just that these things are the most definitive here. That's why there's nine of them, I guess. Chapter 5, verse 3. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And I not only tell you how you're going to be, but you're going to see the result of it. You're going to be able to identify whether you've got to the right place or not. And that's here. It's things you can recognize if you just learn to recognize them. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are ye when men shall revile and persecute you, and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. There's nine of them. Those are the three places that I know of where you get the most information. The Bible and the Book of Mormon, all of the books back these things up. When Jesus Christ was asked what was the greatest commandment, they were setting him up. They were trying to trick him. They were trying to get him to stub his toe theologically, and he just mowed them down because he knew more about it than they did. They were wrapped up in nitpicking, they were wrapped up in phraseology, they were wrapped up in legalisms, they were wrapped up in idolatry, they were wrapped up in all of the things that man does with something that's an abstract. And religion is an abstract. It's the most powerful thing going, but it's an abstract. You can't see it. You can just see the results of it. Jesus Christ turned right around and talked about your soul as an answer. And what the most important part of your soul is, the part that makes you work like a Christian. All of the rest of the things are the result of that, and they're secondary. The ordinances that we perform are secondary to your belief. They're geared to help you remember who God is. That's seen in a lawnmower. If you want it to work, you don't. You put gasoline in a lawnmower. And when it works, you're blessed. And I guess maybe people get tired of being happy. I don't know. Because they go off on other things and do other things to be religious. I think it's in John. 1 John. Now, maybe I'm off base here. Pure religion and undefiled, and I'm going to have to just paraphrase it. I apologize. Pure religion and undefiled. What is it? Oh, and James. You're right. There it is. Thank you very much. First chapter of James, verse 27. Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and widows in their afflictions and to keep himself unspotted from the world. That is not geared to be a bunch of ceremonies. That is not geared to invent a bunch of rituals to go through that. And you don't just run out and visit whoever you find is fatherless and a widow. That is not what that means. You know, if that's all you think it is, then you don't understand. It's like why did it take four Boy Scouts to get the little old lady across the street? Because she didn't want to go. You know, they were going to do a good deed no matter whether she wanted it or not. There's information there that backs all of these other places up. It's just another way of saying it because there's so many of us here. Not everybody's going to understand. That's why you have all these ministries here, because one guy stands up there and gives you his viewpoint all the time. Those of you that don't connect with him out there are never going to get anything out of it. That's why God in his wisdom established his church with a variety of ministries, so you don't get polarized. So you don't get bored to death, or you never understand what's going on up here. Somebody, if you listen to everybody, you're going to connect with them. So to go back to the 12th chapter of the third book of Nephi, page 673, verily I say unto you that ye are built upon my gospel, therefore you shall call whatsoever things you do call in my name. Therefore if you call upon the Father for the church, if it be in my name, the Father will hear you. And if it so be that the church is built upon my gospel, then will the Father shew forth his own works in it. And that is really evident in our church history. If you take a look at what this church has done, and then look at the results of what's happened because of our actions, it's as plain as a nose in your face. It really is. And if you do it right, we grow, and if we do it wrong, we shrink. And if we do it wrong, we don't grow. But if we do it right, we grow. Because people know the difference between good and evil. That's been since Adam and Eve. That's results. That's things you can see. Those are things you can see. But if it not be built upon my gospel, and is built upon the works of men, or upon the works of the devil, verily I say unto you, they have joy in their works for a season, and by the end cometh, and they are hewn down and cast into the fire, and from whence there is no return. For their works do follow them, for it is because of their works that they are hewn down. Therefore remember the things that I have told you. Behold, I have given unto you my gospel, And this is the gospel which I have given unto you, that I came into the world to do the will of my Father, because my Father sent me. And my Father sent me that I might be lifted up upon the cross, and after that I had been lifted up upon the cross, that I might draw all men unto me. You know, sometimes we have trouble getting through the forest because of the trees. Different way of saying that. And sometimes we, and you know, the young people, I'm very sure most of them in here are familiar with that game of letting go of the rod of iron, that the game has been played out many times, and how temptation makes you let go of that rod of iron. Well, just remember, Satan knows more about you than you know about you, and he knows enough about you that he doesn't have to get you to deny Christ. All he has to do is to deflect your attention. And he's accomplished the same thing. These are our rod of iron. And it's not the books themselves, it's what in them, it's what's in them. And it's what you get out of it and do is what or does not make you a child of Christ. I thank you.
Thank you, Roger. Immediately following the close of this service, there'll be our potluck dinner downstairs. You're all invited to attend. And then consult your bulletin for the services through the afternoon. The Spanish service at 2:30. Choir practice at 4. Prayer services at 5:30. And preaching tonight at 6:30. Worship and song at 6:30. We're going to close with hymn number 81. 81. Let us pray. Our righteous Heavenly Father, we are thankful to be able to come to Thee this morning, to bow our knee before Thy throne, to ask forgiveness of our sins, to learn from Thy Scriptures, to accept this beautiful day that You've given us, and to serve You. We ask